Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A study has found that warmer waters off North America's west coast caused many kinds of sea life to move farther north than ever before. The study was a project of scientists from the University of California, Davis. Their findings were reported in the online publication Scientific Reports. The scientists examined waters off the coast of Northern California in the eastern Pacific Ocean. The researchers say they identified a total of 67 species between 2014 and 2016 during what was described as a marine heat wave. Marine heat waves were defined in the study as periods of extreme sea surface temperatures lasting for days to months. The 2014-2016 heat wave is thought to be the largest ever recorded. The report says this weather event began in 2013 when a warm water blob formed in the Gulf of Alaska. The warm water later moved southward toward California. The warmer waters were partly a product of El Niño conditions during the same period, researchers noted. El Niño develops when winds off the coast of South America weaken. This enables warm water in the western Pacific to move eastward. El Niño often causes ocean temperatures in the area to rise between 2 to 4 degrees Celsius, the study found. The researchers reported that 37 of the 67 species they studied had never before been observed so far north as California. These creatures are native to an area hundreds of kilometers to the south, mainly around Baja California in Mexico. Some species were discovered outside a marine laboratory belonging to the University of California, Davis. A few were even found north of California, off the state of Oregon. The northward travel of so many different sea creatures was considered unprecedented by the researchers. Among the species identified in the study were a meat-eating sea slug that hunts other sea slugs, a sea snail butterfly, and a purple-lined jellyfish. Another unexpected visitor was the pelagic red crab, which researchers said had only been found in areas off the coast of Mexico. Scientists involved in the study believe the findings can provide valuable information for predicting future sea life reactions to warming oceans. There is also evidence suggesting that warming waters in the Atlantic Ocean have caused some sea creatures to move northward. A 2017 report in Yale University's online magazine Environment 360 explores this subject. The report notes that for many years, the ocean has served as our best defense against climate change. This is because ocean waters have taken in nearly all of the atmosphere's extra heat. This has led to warmer oceans, with experts predicting continuing rising temperatures. Warmer waters along the U.S. East Coast have affected the black sea bass. Researchers from Rutgers University reported the fish once was mainly found off the coast of North Carolina. But they discovered the species had traveled more than 700 kilometers northward to waters off the coast of New Jersey, Environment 360 reported. A 2018 Rutgers study estimated climate change will force hundreds of fish species and other creatures to seek out cooler waters in coming years. Using climate models, researchers predicted that some species along the U.S. and Canadian Pacific coasts will move as far as 1,400 kilometers north from their current habitats. Such movement is expected to cause major difficulties for fisheries both in the U.S. and Canada, the study found. I'm Brian Lynn.
Joshua Clark is happy as he sits down to read a book to his son, Mason. But Clark remembers not always being happy about reading.
I remember my mom almost forced me to read books during those summer reports right before you get back to school, and it was tough.
Reading became like work to him. He decided that when he had his own child, he would make sure reading was an enjoyable experience.
When you can present things in a joyous way and not that it be a task, you're more willing to do it, and so I want to provide that for my son.
Today, Clark and his son live in Washington, D.C. The young father has been able to read many great stories to 3-year-old Mason thanks to a local program called Books from Birth. Through Books from Birth, Clark and others who take part receive one high-quality book each month in the mail. The program is open to D.C. residents with a child under the age of 5. Books from Birth began 3 years ago. Clark joined the program before Mason was even born. Clark knew the program would help him feel closer to his son, as well as help his son learn.
I knew I could use this tool to not only bond with my son, but also give him skills that he would need in everyday, daily life.
The program sends each child age-appropriate books. So early ones may teach simple shapes and sounds. The books become more complex as the child grows. Clark says monthly books are helping Mason learn many new words. Clark says he will repeat a word and understand it, and later on repeat it and use it in a way that was used with him. And that is the goal of the program, said Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser. She recently spoke at a news conference celebrating the program's 3rd anniversary.
We know from all of the research that children who are read to, sung to as well at home, have a vocabulary that is vastly larger than children, unfortunately, who come to school without that type of preparation.
Bowser added that having a larger vocabulary means children may read sooner and learn more once they begin school. D.C. Council member Charles Allen introduced the law that established the project. He said,
when I first got elected to the council, I had a 2-year-old daughter, she's 6 now, but I saw that in her bedroom, she had dozens and dozens, if not 100 books. That's not the reality for every home in D.C., and I wanted to do something quickly about early childhood education and early literacy.
Mason's mother, Margaret Parker, says she likes how books from birth can help her teach her son another language, too.
Teaching him another language is something that I've always had an interest in. And getting those English, Spanish books have been a great follow-up to songs that we sing or words that I teach him or things that he pick up at school.
Parker says the books are carefully chosen to teach other important skills as well. For example, one of the books Mason received was all about bugs or insects.
We're outside kind of exploring, and one of his friends, I guess, wanted to step on one of the bugs, and he said, oh no, don't squish bugs, a part of one of the books that we read with him. So I thought that was pretty cool to see him make that connection between the two.
The DC Books from Birth program is a local partner of Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. The singer-songwriter started the program in 1995 in her home state of Tennessee in honor of her father, who could not read or write. The organization mails a book to a child's home once a month, from birth until the child turns 5. The organization has sent out more than 115 million books to children in Australia, Canada, Ireland, Britain, and the United States. The goal in America's capital is to have 100% participation, especially among poorer families, says D.C. Public Library Chief Richard Reyes-Gavilan. He says it is difficult for busy working families to visit a library every week or month. But with Books from Birth, the library comes to them. I'm Jill Robbins.
Setsuko Takamizawa is set to prove that it is never too late to learn. At the age of 91, the great-grandmother is learning English with the help of her family. She hopes to use the language at next year's Olympic Games in Tokyo. Takamizawa was one of the more than 200,000 people who requested to volunteer for Tokyo's 2020 Games. English is not required for service, but it is a helpful skill for volunteers to have. But Takamizawa had not been able to learn the language when she was young. Takamizawa told Reuters that she was in high school when World War II started. She said, "In my second year there, English was banned because it was the enemy language." Takamizawa said that her grandchildren helped persuade her she was not too old to learn. "When I talked to my grandchildren about my wish, they said, 'It's not too late. We will teach you one word a day. It's going to be a good challenge for you.'" Natsuko is Takamizawa's granddaughter and main English teacher. Natsuko sends a new English word to her grandmother's phone every day. They also often work together directly on phrases that Takamizawa will need for the Olympics. "Welcome to Tokyo. This is the Olympic Stadium. How can I help you?" Takamizawa answers when asked to say an English phrase she has learned. Natsuko explains that she wanted to give her grandmother something to enjoy. "I can clearly see her English is getting better. It's my joy now." The EF English Proficiency Index is a measure of the level of English spoken in a country. Japan ranks 49th among countries where English is not the first language. This situation is slowly changing as younger generations welcome English. Japanese students often learn English at a much younger age than they did in the past. However, Takamizawa believes real change will not happen unless Japanese people become more open to the rest of the world. She says that people in Japan should act not only as Japanese citizens, but also as global members of the Earth. With around 500 days to go until the games begin, the whole Takamizawa family is ready to welcome the world to Tokyo. When Japan last held the Summer Olympics in 1964, Takamizawa was too busy raising a family to go to any events. Takamizawa said she never thought the Olympics would happen in Tokyo twice in her lifetime. "It's good," she said, "to live long." I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. During the 1800s, the federal government forced Native American Indians to live in special areas. These were called reservations. The Indians no longer could move freely over the Great Plains to hunt buffalo. White men were settling there. The situation resulted in violence. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of these Western wars.
The government sent soldiers to force the Indians to move to reservations. But the soldiers could not keep them there. Groups of Indians would leave the reservations in the spring. They followed the buffalo across the plains. Some raided the homes of white settlers. They stole horses and cattle. At the end of the summer, the Indians would return to the reservations, and the government would give them food for the winter.
As years passed, fewer Indians left the reservations to live the old life on the plains. It became difficult to find buffalo. The plains were becoming empty. Only a few years before, millions of buffalo lived on the Great Plains. Then railroads were built across the country. White men came to claim the grasslands. They put up fences. Cowboys came up from Texas with huge groups of cattle. They forced the buffalo away or killed them. The Indians tried to prevent this killing. Angry groups of Indians often attacked white buffalo hunters. But the army was too strong. Soldiers killed or captured many Indians. Finally, most Indians gave up the struggle. They surrendered their guns and horses. They went back to the reservations and became farmers.
All this was taking place in what is now the south central part of the United States. Far to the north, another struggle was taking place involving the Great Sioux Indian tribe. The Sioux had signed a treaty with the government in 1868. The treaty gave them a large reservation in what is now Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wyoming. The Black Hills in Dakota were part of the reservation. These hills were important to the Sioux. In their religion, the Black Hills were a holy place. They were the center of their world, where the gods lived. They were the place where Indian fighters went to speak with the Great Spirit.
In 1873, the Black Hills suddenly became important to white men, too. Gold was discovered there. Treaties and religion meant nothing to the white miners who rushed to the Black Hills to search for gold. At first, the Indians killed some of the miners. They chased others away. But more miners came. The Sioux tribe asked the government to enforce the treaty. Tribal leaders asked the government to keep white men away from the reservation. The army sent soldiers to remove the miners. The soldiers ordered the miners to leave, but they made no effort to enforce the order. Again, the Indians protested. This time, the government sent officials to negotiate a new treaty. It asked the Sioux Indians to give up the Black Hills. Some of the Indian leaders refused to negotiate. One who rejected the invitation was Sitting Bull. "I do not want to sell any land to the government," Chief Sitting Bull said. He held a little dust between his fingers. "Not even this much."
This resistance did not stop government efforts to get the Black Hills for the miners. The War Department sent General George Crook to punish the Indians and force them back to their reservation. Crook led a large force into Sioux country. He surprised an Indian village, capturing hundreds of horses. There was another clash a few months later. This time, the result was very different. The Indians gave the army its worst defeat in almost a century.
The battle took place near the Little Bighorn River. General George Custer led 212 soldiers in search of the Indian leader Crazy Horse. As General Custer moved through the river valley, he sent men ahead to explore the area. His men returned with reports that thousands of Indians were waiting to attack. Custer refused to listen. He pushed forward. Soon his forces were surrounded by Indians. In less than an hour, the Indians killed the general and every one of his men. The white soldiers lay dead at Little Bighorn. And Custer's name would go down in history as a symbol of foolish pride in battle. The battle at Little Bighorn was a serious defeat for the United States Army. But the Indians' victory did not last long. Within a year, the Army forced most of the Sioux to surrender. It took the Black Hills for the miners. It moved the Indians to a new reservation.
In In the next few years, the same thing happened to other Indian tribes throughout the West. Under great pressure from white settlers, the government took land from the Indians and opened it to settlement. The size of Indian reservations was reduced again and again. One by one, the Indian tribes of the West changed. Their fierce fighters became farmers who needed government help. They were weak and broken in spirit. One Indian leader named Black Elk described the situation best. He was a survivor of a battle at a place called Wounded Knee. Many Indian women and children had died there. Years later, Black Elk said, "I did not know then how much was ended. When I look back now from this high hill of my old age, I can still see the dead lying all over the ground. And I can see that something else died there in the bloody mud and was buried. A people's dream died there."
Some Indians turned to religion during this difficult time. An Indian religious leader named Wovoka gained influence. Wovoka declared that the Great Spirit had chosen him to prepare the Indians for a new world. He said the new world would arrive soon, and it would be a wonderful world. There would be no white men, he said, and all dead Indians would come back to life. Wovoka warned that new soil would rise up and cover the world like a flood. He said Indians could escape destruction by dancing a special dance. It was called the Ghost Dance. Wovoka said the ghost dance would make Indians powerful. He said it would even protect them from bullets fired by the white men's guns.
Thousands of Indians in the American West listened to Wovoka's message. They believed him, and they began to dance for long hours every day. On the Sioux reservations, all other activities stopped. Children no longer went to school. No one did anything but dance. All this frightened white officials. They tried to arrest some Indian leaders to stop the dancing. The arrests led to fighting, and the fighting led to a final battle in which the army defeated the Indians completely. The Indian wars were over. Wovoka himself told his followers, "Our trails are covered with grass and sand. We cannot find them. Today, I call upon you to travel a new trail. It is the only trail now open, the white man's road."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.